Hello, I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, with a series of interviews with contributors to New Male Studies. This open access international journal is available online. Go to newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. The practice of female circumcision has received much media coverage around the world in recent years, and the practice is prohibited by law in most Western countries. It would seem, however, that there is much less interest in discussing the practice of male circumcision. The completely unregulated practice of male circumcision is the challenging title of an article in New Male Studies, Volume 2, Issue 1, 2013. The author is John V. Geisiker, Professor of Law and Executive Director of Doctors Opposing Circumcision. Although based in Seattle in the United States, he's proud to claim that in the 1960s, the land of his birth, New Zealand, fully abandoned medicalized infant circumcision as unnecessary, with no negative child health consequences. This interview was recorded via Skype in January 2013. I began by asking John V. Geisiker to reflect on the background to the practice of circumcision, both male and female.
Well, I have to tell you that male circumcision is basically an invention of the Anglo-American medical establishment in the mid to late 19th century. It was a time when medical people did not understand disease. And so they established a theory called reflex neurosis, which suggested that if somebody touched a sensitive part of their body, they might cause a disease to appear remotely elsewhere in their body, hence the term reflux. For instance, if you were a mother in 1870 in either the United States or England or Australia or New Zealand, and you took your sick child to the doctor might say, my, I think your son has consumption, which we now know as TB, and that's because he's been touching his penis. And the mother would say, well, my God, doctor, this is horrible. What can I do? And the doctor would say, well, the best thing we could do, of course, is to cut off his foreskin, which is the most sensitive part of his genitalia, and that would stop him from touching it and perhaps slow the progress of his consumption. So that's the origins, and it's a bit sinister, you have to admit.
Indeed.
Of circumcision in the Anglophone medical community and in Anglophone culture generally. I mean, when you talk about it, you cannot isolate the fact, or you ought to isolate the fact, that circumcision is an Anglophone, an English-speaking phenomenon. It's not a phenomenon of the European peoples who rejected it in the 19th century as basically British silliness. Now, you also asked about female circumcision. An entirely different topic, but not actually entirely. There are an awful lot of people who, the moment you mention female and male circumcision in the same sentence, will instantly say, well, of course, they're quite different. Female circumcision was intended to reduce sexual sensation and to keep females loyal to their husbands. And male circumcision was nothing of the sort. It was intended only to provide prophylaxis, some sort of health or cleanliness. But the fact of the matter is that both spring from the same wellspring, which is an intention to dampen sexual sensation, both of children and of adults.
In your paper, you write, while genital cutting of female minors for any reason, whether with pious intentions or not, has been fully proscribed in most Western countries, nowhere is medically unnecessary male genital cutting of minors illegal. That's a very strong sentence.
Well, and it's also completely true, or I wouldn't have written it. The fact of the matter is that most people in most countries, well beyond the English-speaking world, are appalled and horrified by female circumcision. But male circumcision, on the other hand, because it is so deeply embedded in two religious traditions and an awful lot of cultural traditions, seems normative. I mean, I read constantly on this. I've been doing little else of these 13 years than studying this. When I read comments on it, people always say, well, you can't compare the two. And the answer is, yes, you can. You can compare the two because they spring from the same notions of sexual control and damaging someone's mechanism by which they might have some sort of sexual satisfaction. So the two are related, but frankly, I often keep them apart because if you discuss male and female circumcision together, everyone's horrified by female and they instantly say the male is fine. And so at that point, you have lost the argument and lost the discussion because you have no way to really argue what is true, which is what has been lost of the male and what has been lost of the female, and what's the effect on the male or female lifetime.
Do we have any statistics on the prevalence of circumcision, say in your country, in the United States or Canada or England or Australia? How widespread is it?
Well, because it was an English language phenomenon, of course, there are some pretty good statistics about its incidence. I mean, I have to tell you, first off, that I am a New Zealander by birth. I went to university there in my late teens, and I visit there frequently. And in fact, in 3 days, I will be in my native land again. And I'm delighted to say that it's a wonderful occasion for me because I know that all the little boys and teenagers, et cetera, whom I see on the street are intact because New Zealand gave up the practice in the 1960s fully, just as the British did in the 1950s. So it has ceased to be a problem in my native land, and it's a minor problem in the UK. It continues to be a not insignificant problem in Australia and Canada, and it's a huge problem in the US. I can give you some rough numbers. I can't defend these instantly because, of course, it requires some research. But in the U.S., approximately 70% of men have been circumcised. The rate now is under 50% of neonates, that is, children who are circumcised. In Canada, to my immediate north, and I'm only about 2 hours of a car drive south of Canada, the rate is perhaps around 12%, very similar to Australia, I might add. So in other words, of the major Anglophone countries, the United States, the rate's 50%. The UK, the rate is for children, basically zero. Of New Zealand, basically zero. Of Canada, well, perhaps 10 or 12%. And of Australia, 10 or 12%. So those are the English-speaking countries where the numbers are an issue.
The paper you have written has been published through New Male Studies, the online journal. I was very interested to read some of the kind of contexts in which male circumcision takes place. And you talk about lay circumcisers, and you talk about the healing arts professional, with healing arts very much in inverted commas. Could you elaborate a little bit on these? They sound all rather horrifying, I have to say.
There are two circumcision traditions, and we need to deal with them separately, although eventually they, of course, coalesce. And that is the lay circumcision tradition, which includes the Muslim and Jewish and Coptic Christian and animist tradition. And then there's the medical tradition, which infects Anglophone countries. So they're parallel to each other. And curiously enough, the Anglophone medical tradition in the 19th century did not really rely heavily on the Jewish or Muslim tradition. It was its kind of own thing, although they interpenetrate each other. That is to say, the medical tradition relies on getting some reverence from the religious tradition. And the religious tradition relies on its continuity for some medical justifications. So the two cross over in various ways, and actually quite complicated ways. It can't easily be summarized. But the fact of the matter is that there are these two parallel traditions, the medical and the religious. Now, I have to tell you that, of course, one of the problems that I've mentioned in my paper is that the religious tradition has absolutely no, and I mean no, sort of legal restrictions or qualifications or demarcations whatsoever. The medical restriction is no better. It actually has very few restrictions or requirements or protections for the child. And so one of the things that I mentioned in my paper is that, frankly, this practice is completely and utterly unregulated.
You use the word enshrined, which is, again, a fairly strong word.
Well, I mean, it's true. In both California and Germany, as I have done my studies, the practice of male circumcision has been enshrined in a sense that the local laws have protected parents and practitioners from any sort of legal attack and basically left the child on his own. What's happened is that the laws have suggested that there can be no medical or legal attacks on the practice because the laws have basically enshrined it. They basically have said male circumcision must go on. Whereas, of course, in the female environment, there has been a sense that female circumcision is sexually destructive and inappropriate and unethical and painful and hurts the woman and damages her rights to her own body. But the male circumcision right has had no such analysis. And any attempt to basically equate the two has met with failure.
You also note an assumption that all males are anatomically equivalent. Again, that's not the case, is it?
Well, it certainly is not. I mean, obviously one can envision a boy, soon to become a man eventually, who could not withstand the diminution in sexual sensation and even genital nerve supply, we could say. And that boy can't be identified prior to his circumcision. I mean, there's no way to know which boy can withstand circumcision and manage his own life for a lifetime, and which boys will be grievously harmed by that because they were deprived of sexual sensation in childhood that they never had the right to enjoy. So, I mean, the fact of the matter is that anyone who is circumcising a child has no way to know whether the child can withstand the trauma and can withstand the loss or not.
This raises the question of training. Who is actually trained to carry out this procedure properly, if I can use that word?
I mean, I think in my paper I mentioned the fact that in American medical education, the people who are typically empowered to do circumcisions have no training whatsoever about male genitalia or male neurology. Typically, the tissue that's lost has not been explored by the medical profession, whether histologically or anatomically or neurologically. And so such persons are basically inclined to cut off part of the body that they don't even understand. The same can be said of ritual circumcisers. They have no way of knowing what it is they're cutting off. And the claims that they have that they are highly trained is that they're highly trained in basically recitation of incantations, of ancient incantations that are religious, that have nothing to do with medicine. They have no reason to be well-educated about the tissue they're cutting off. Why would they indeed understand the tissue they're cutting off? Because, of course, they're committed to doing so. So whether it's in the medical environment or the religious environment, both groups in America, it tends to be residents, are ones, that is, first-year medical students who do the task, or OBGYNs, that is, obstetrician gynecologists who also do the task, or religious and ritual circumcisers. Neither group has any particular claim to understanding the tissue that they're amputating. One of the things that interests me is that when people oppose female circumcision, they talk about how the fact that the circumciser takes away part of the female body that gives her sexual pleasure. And that's the horrifying part about FGM and the reason why people who oppose FGM do so vehemently. But the fact of the matter is that male circumcision suffers from the same history. I mean, whether in the medical or the religious setting, the entire point of circumcision was to reduce the male's sexual sensation so as to prevent sexual excess, which in the 19th century was thought to cause disease, and which in centuries past was thought to at least cause some sort of moral decay. But the fact of the matter is that anatomically, circumcision basically ablates the male's sexual sensation, the primary erogenous zone. The glands, the little fireman's hat, the pointy end of the penis, is actually rather insensate. It's about as sensitive as an earlobe and has only primitive protopathic sensors. The real sensitivity of the male's of the male penis is in the foreskin, which, if you think about it, is the skin that touches the partner in sexual intercourse, and so it makes perfect sense that nature designed the male to have an organ whose sexual sensation is mostly covered by the foreskin when it's folded over, and is not available under normal circumstances, but becomes available for sexual intercourse and then appears. And it's actually a wonderful design. The fact of the matter is that cutting it off does a huge disservice to males. And this is not well known. I mean, most commentators on circumcision think of it as benign. They think of it as something that does absolutely nothing to the human. Very similar to the Anglophone comments about tonsillectomies, for instance. In the 1950s, many people had tonsillectomies, and they did not. The first time you had a big cold, you got a tonsillectomy in the United States. Even though later on, years later, medical authorities discovered that the tonsils are the body's first line of defense against enteroviruses like poliomyelitis. And so that's when tonsillectomies dropped off. But the fact of the matter is that the foreskin has never been really protected. It's never been really thought of as the male's primary erogenous zone. And so in a way, all discussions about circumcision are basically predicated on the notion that the foreskin is nothing, that it has no sensation, that it means nothing, and that its loss is merely cultural.
Why is there, in this context, no procedure for what you refer to as a procedural pause?
Well, I mean, I think that's just sheer laziness. I mean, I'm married to a woman who's a medical professional, and I understand well that medical procedures of any kind have to have a procedural pause where everyone stops and identifies the patient, identifies the procedure, identifies what really will happen. And unfortunately, circumcision is considered a rather minor procedure, and it doesn't have enough, what would you call it? It doesn't have enough gravitas to suggest that medical people should give it a procedural pause. So, of course, what happens is that it's given to the lowest person on the medical tree, and that person has no real worries because they are doing a procedure that is barely considered surgery. So, of course, the procedural pause, it basically becomes irrelevant.
John, let's move on to the boy, the young man himself. And you're right, the growing boy himself is left to assume certain things as he looks downwards. Could you maybe reflect on the experience of boys that you've met, young men that you've met, as they come to terms with what's been done to them?
Well, I mean, I have to say that it's a melancholy business, but I have had emails and telephone calls for years. I've been doing this work for over a decade, from young men who didn't really discover what circumcision was until they were in their late teens or early 20s. And they were sort of mystified by what had happened to them. And the only reason they found that out is because they happened to run across men who were intact. And perhaps that was at a gymnasium or a hot tub or something of that sort, where they got to see other men and made inquiries. And these young men are often deeply, deeply disturbed by the fact that they seem to be missing something and appear like something way different from the men they saw. And so what happens is that the young man, unless he's been prepared by his parents, and what parents would ever do that, he's basically headed for a surprise. He's headed for some sort of, what happened to me, Mom? What happened to me, Dad? And of course, the mom and dad who perhaps had the best of intentions, said, "Well, son, we were told that we needed to do that, and we're sorry that you're not pleased by it, but that's what we decided to do when you were a baby." And so the fact of the matter is that young men are often hugely surprised by this and uniquely disadvantaged by it. And those calls come to me, and frankly, they are very challenging.
How do you go about helping a young man in that situation?
Well, I can't, of course. If they're angry about being circumcised, there's very little I can do. Although I usually advise all of them to consider non-surgical foreskin restoration, which is well-developed. There are many hundreds of thousands of men actually doing that now in the English-speaking world. There are many commercial devices that the boy could use. And I think this is the best I can offer them in the way of reassurance.
Well, this leads us to the whole question of the rights of men and the rights of boys. What can be done in this situation?
Well, at the moment, very little. I mean, unfortunately, I've spent 13 years working on this topic, and I'm actually seeing things go backwards. I'm actually seeing countries like the U.S. in the instance of California, and Germany with the latest pronouncement, basically enshrining male circumcision as an event that parents can impose on their children without any restriction. And so, frankly, when I started doing this work, I had no idea that there would come a time when lawmakers would make circumcision almost mandatory. They would make it something that a parent can impose without the slightest question about the physical outfall. And that's the appalling part. I mean, I think that we who oppose the practice have had some successes, but frankly, with the California law and the German law, boy, it's very hard to see how those successes are holding up.
I've been speaking with Seattle-based law professor John V. Geisiker, executive director of Doctors Opposing Circumcision. He is the author of the article, The Completely Unregulated Practice of Male Circumcision, published in New Male Studies, Volume 2, Issue 1, 2013. It's available in full online. Simply go to newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. This Skype interview was recorded in January 2013. In Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan.